football on Off the Ball.
So he brought Max Damon on, who's not 16 until December, by the way. It's sort of ridiculous. I can't really explain it, to see a 15-year-old come on and do what he did.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Tonight's a very emotional night for us on Off the Ball. And I think for anybody who fully understands the impact that John Giles has had on Irish life. And I use Irish life as opposed to Irish football because I think it's true. And the lads are going to talk about his impact on culture and on what it means to have been an Irish footballer and for the Irish emigrant experience and what it's like to be a leader of men. But I actually just want to talk specifically about broadcasting because that's our area of expertise. And I can say without fear of contradiction that Off the Ball wouldn't exist the way it does today without the existence of John Giles. I don't mean because he signed for us in 2002 after Saipan. I mean because in the 1990s, there was nowhere in Ireland where you could listen to the radio and hear people who really loved sport talking about sport in a way that took it seriously, that understood that it meant something to people like us, to the people in the room here who love sport and who actually paid attention to what was going on. It was kind of treated as something that was second class and not really important, and particularly football, right? Like, there was a lot of self-regarding about other sports, and there was a lot of nationalistic fervor around other sports. But when it came to football, no one took it seriously on a regular basis. The games were on TV, and you could watch Match of the Day, but you couldn't actually listen to intelligent people having conversations about football on a regular basis until John would join Eamon on the radio on The Last Word in the mid-90s. So I was in college at this stage, and when we got the opportunity to create Off the Ball in 2002, it was very obvious that all we were going to do was copy what the lads on The Last Word were doing in as good a manner as we could possibly do. It wasn't as good as what they were doing. It was like, in our wildest dreams, would we ever be as good as The Last Word were at talking about sport on the radio. And then Saipan happened, right? I don't know if everybody understands exactly, you know. There was a minor issue around some stuff which we're not allowed to talk about anymore. But that issue, you know, it became a real thing, and friends fell out, families fell out. And I got a phone call from Leonard Ryan, who was on the board of News Talk, who was Mickey O'Rourke's business partner. You might know Mickey. He's one of the owners of Shelburne at the moment. And he says, so I was the sports editor. I was 24 at the time. And he rings and he says, John Giles is available. And I was like, what do you mean he's available? He's like, what do you mean? He's like, he's available. If we sign him, he will come and join us. And I was like, I mean, are you drunk? What are you talking about? But I rang John, and lo and behold, in 2002, at the height of the most important story in the history of Irish football, John joined Off the Ball, and he's been a fixture with us ever since. And, I really can't explain how important that was in terms of our credibility. And, you know, he would have a quiet word afterwards going, maybe we'll do a little bit less of this and a bit more of this. And we were privileged. 22 years on, 23 years on, Off the Ball has millions and millions of social views, and it has the highest listenership we've ever had. 7 days a week, 300,000 people listen at the weekend, 60,000 people listen every night. But the style of broadcasting that you get when people talk about sport in Ireland, it's all based on the conversations that the lads were having in the mid-90s. And it's better than the stuff that you get in England where it's all, hey, banter, oh, hey, what's it going? And it's better than the stuff you get in America, which is all just phone-in where people are angry. You actually get people who really care about it, and they also have a little bit of devil in them. We all listen to the stories of Joys and the Nights Out and the Sing Songs and the Bacardis and Coke, and we took that to heart, and we've lived our lives accordingly. So it has been our privilege to spend some time in the company of John every Thursday night for 23 years. But the previous 10 years, I would argue, are even more important in terms of his legacy. So tonight, we're not just talking about John the football man. We're talking about John Giles, the man. Enjoy the evening, folks.
The young Giles, he seems to be an inside forward with a very great future.
Oh, there's no question
about that at all. He's a wonderful player. He's a very quick football brain, and he was given the opportunity to use it.
The rest of the was headed up by Johansson, comes to Giles, who shoots, and it's a goal! It's a wonderful goal!
Unforgettable. Well, I think it was the climate of the times, Jim. You know, I played Manchester United, had my leg broken at Birmingham. And I think during the 60s, it was a very, very tough game. And there was a lot of physical stuff, and I was regarded as a skillful player. And when you're a skillful player, you're a target. And my attitude was, well, if I'm going to make a living in this game and I want to make it, then I'm going to have to be as tough as everybody else. And I set out to do that.
Lorimer will play it wide again for Giles to drive it. And there it is from Johnny Giles.
When we came out of the second division, we scrambled a lot and we played scrambly football. Very tenacious, very resilient in what we're doing. And at times, too naughty for our own. All the things that they say about Leeds, the bad things they say about it, they knew as players that we were a great team.
Giles, Alistair Brown, and again Giles. Good try, it's worked! Oh yes, Johnny Giles!
Bobby Collins was, you remember Bobby Collins? Bobby Collins was a great Scottish player that played for Leeds. And he used to have a saying for the players when he was rating players. You know what he used to say? Would he kill his granny? It's true. Would he kill his granny?
Yeah.
And Bobby Collins would kill his granny and his grandfather.
Okay,
to win,
so what we're
to,
saying
to win a
we're,
match.
What we're saying tonight then, that England have got to get a manager who knows all about back alleys.
Yeah.
And they got to have players who will kill their grannies.
Duncan was a trickster anyway. He could do all sorts of tricks on and off the pitch. He could jump over a mini jar. Did you ever hear about that?
No.
Duncan McKenzie.
What?
What he did, actually, Jack, he sort of only strolled up to it, two or three strides, and I honestly thought he was going to turn back and say, oh, look, lads, I'm only joking. Hopped over it. Hopped over the mini.
In one go?
In one go.
Franny Lee. You know, Franny was...
Man City
yeah. lad. And Franny could dish it about. As it happened, the players crossed, you know, first place novel was Mike Summerby. Do you remember Mike Summerby?
He
could get stuck in as well.
Right.
You know, my reaction was, you keep your fucking nose out. See? And Billy says, have you seen the size of his nose, wee man? You see?
Well, when you see a player playing, Nathan, who needs to kick up the backside, you don't have to know him, you know. Like, if he needs to kick up the backside, he needs to kick up the backside.
Johnny Giles, then, with the kick. He scores, it's 1-0 Leeds. And Bremner leaps to his feet. He could tell by the roar of the crowd.
Thanks, Richie.
Okay, Nathan.
John, good evening to you. How are you?
Good evening, Chair.
John, how are you doing? You're there?
I'm here, Adrian. Yeah, I'm good. Good. I hope everything works out okay, Joe. That's the main thing now.
Thinks that I am unforgettable too.
What a day for he. What a day for the Ireland side. And what a tribute to the man who's masterminded it all, Johnny Giles.
Good evening, everybody.
Evening, everyone. How are you all doing?
So we are here tonight to celebrate not just the impact John has had on off the ball over the last 20 years or so, but really the unrivaled impact that he's had on Irish football going back 70 years. This stage, it's hard to get your head around. It was 1956 when John first left Ormond Square, just a couple of kilometres from here in Dublin, and got the boat over and signed for Manchester United. Matt Busby was the manager at the Busby Babes, just a couple of years before the Munich air disaster, where John was in the training ground in the days afterwards, before he'd made his debut. Made his Ireland debut as a teenager at 18 years of age. Now, word had spread, I think, even in 1959 about this kid, that he was like no other, that he was a footballer like no other. So let's go back to 1959 and a little glimpse of John Giles on his Republic of Ireland debut.
But then the dismayed crowd had the tonic of an Irish goal scored by 18-year-old Johnny Giles playing in his first international. The roar which greeted this goal was almost deafening in its intensity. It was the Daily Mount roar at full volume.
There's another chance for Ireland to fake the centre. It's a beautiful ball. The rest of the was headed up by Johansson. Comes to Giles, who shoots, and it's a wonderful goal.
think we'll have to get John to use his best descriptive powers later on to describe that goal.
Video was very expensive, so they just stopped when the actual match started. But trust us, he played well and he scored.
As Nathan mentioned, it was a story of hopping on the boat as a 15-year-old going over to Manchester United. A massive learning curve for John Giles, and maybe the greatest day for John in that Manchester United team came around 5 years later in 1963 when he was an FA Cup champion. You can see this photograph there of John on the pitch at Wembley. He started that day because Nobby Stiles had picked up an injury, and I'm delighted to say that we have some members of the Stiles family here. We'll be speaking to John a little bit later on tonight as well. But that summer was going to be a seismic summer for John, because it was the summer that marked the end of his Manchester United career, and the summer where he said, "I am going to haunt Matt Busby."
Yeah, the summer of 63, a seminal moment in the history of Irish football, and particularly special for John as he joined Leeds United at the time, hoping to become an all-conquering force, which they would over the following decade. During his time under Don Revie, won two league titles, won an FA Cup, a League Cup, played in European Cup finals, and part of one of the most famous teams of that era. We've some of them here tonight, but the likes of Jack Charlton, Norman Hunter, Eddie Gray, Peter Lorimer, I think they live in everybody's memory because of how John has kept them going over the last few years. John, as a player, was hugely influential on that team under Don Revie. He was maybe the best passer in English football at the time. He was a tough but a fair tackler, as he tells us, and a scorer of some pretty special goals.
Giles! Superbly taken by the man for me, who's been the player of the match.
Not bad.
Giles. And a goal! Scored by Johnny Giles.
Off the right foot.
Giles. Having a go and wide. He got it! My word,
not a bad left either.
Space opening up for Trevor Cherry. Running to Giles. Tries again, and that's a far better one. Beats him on the other side this time. A beautiful goal by Johnny Giles.
John Giles, goal machine, everyone. John reckoned things were a little bit too easy at that point. He said, "I need to go and double job. I need to become a player manager." And after 12 brilliant years at Leeds United, he went on to West Bromwich Albion, where he got them promoted, had a brilliant stint at West Brom. And most importantly, he continued to score screamers.
Ball over the line again. Giles. Alistair Brown. And again Giles. Good try! Oh, yes! Johnny Giles!
And the celebration stays consistent.
The player manager gets Albion off to a tremendous start.
It is hard to get your head around what John was doing during that period. So he also became the player manager of the Republic of Ireland in 1973. And there's this incredible period where in May 1974, John wins the league as a player with Leeds United and an instrumental player in that team. 6 months later, the USSR come to town at Daly Mount Park, and John is the player manager of the national team as we put in one of our greatest ever performances, Liam Brady debut, Don Givens hat-trick, John running the show in midfield. And 6 months after that, he's back playing in a European Cup final with Leeds United as well, all the time double-jobbing. I'd imagine Anya didn't see much of him during that period, it's fair to say. But he really, I think, transformed expectations around the international side and what we thought of international football and what we thought Ireland could achieve on international football.
Certainly, and in terms of a club contribution, he comes back to Ireland after that point, joins Shamrock Rovers and gives a brilliant stint to domestic football here in Ireland, and then spreads his wings a little bit further. Philadelphia Fury, the greatest kit in the history of football. I mean, that is amazing. And of course, the Vancouver Whitecaps as well, part of his stint in North America.
That is some serious hair, John, it's got to be said. Late 70s, early 80s. Of course, the John Giles that maybe our generation remember is John, the senior analyst and such a key part of the panel with Bill and with Eamon and with Liam. And as I think Jer has outlined, just changed the way that we talk about football, how we think about football, what we expect from how football should be played in this country. I think his analysis, his refusal to indulge in the nonsense that often goes with how we talk about the game. So that impact was long. It was special. There's many clips, I think, that we might play over the course of the evening from the panel, but we give you a small little sample now.
It was total lack of discipline, Billy.
It's terrible to see. They were playing so well, and then they destroyed themselves, really, didn't they?
Yeah, self-destructive. Well, he's that type of player, you know. You could tell by him. You can tell by his face. He's a bit of a headbanger. And
can you tell by his face?
Nah, he's a whole attitude.
The thing that John doesn't like about this is John was the gentle assassin. What John doesn't like about your man is that he got caught.
Yeah,
and he was so obvious.
He
looked as if he was.
There might be another.
I hear he was a really good player, actually.
Yeah, he was a good digger, but he was a headbanger, and he might not be the only one.
Speaking of headbangers, John Giles decided to work with a whole bunch of them for the last 23 years, and he joins News Talk in 2002. Collection of some of the hot shot hosts there that John Giles has firmly put back in their boxes down through the last 23 years. Front and centre there, Nathan. I think you're his favourite.
No. He just doesn't want to speak about the last year anyways. Oh, and listen, whatever's brought about this retirement, I don't know what the fact is. It certainly wasn't you. Don't worry about that. Listen, we're going to try and pay tribute to what this man has done for Irish football over the next couple of hours. We have some brilliant guests lined up. But please, let's welcome to the stage and give it up for the great John Giles.
John, good to see you.
How are you?
Probably a bit too much. Good, good. No problem.
What's a headbanger? What's a headbanger?
Headbanger in football is somebody who has some talent but can give somebody a head if somebody's next to him and get into trouble all the time.
It's fair.
Quite a few around, actually.
John, we've been so lucky as a radio station, as a programme over the last 23 years to have you impart your wisdom on the game of football to us. I've always wondered, where did that begin for you in terms of your knowledge for and your love for football? Because it goes way back to before Manchester United.
For football, it was from the time I was a kid. I was born and raised in Ormond Square, which is just off the quays. Most people here would know where that was. And that was ideal for football. It was a square, cars couldn't come through, and myself involved with a bouncer, and lads that played in the square, and some came from outside the square. So it was ideal for actually playing with the bouncer, because the bouncer was harder to control than the proper football. So, and there was a few lads who didn't live in the square, so I used to mind the ball, so I could go out anytime I wanted and do a bit of practice, keeping the ball up and all that, carry on, which was vital. You know, control of the ball is 90% of the game, if not more. You know, you can have all the ability in the world, but if the ball comes and you can't control it, then you're not going to be any good. So I had the keeping of the ball, so I could do a bit of practice with him before the other lads came up. But that was the start. I was only about 6, 7 years of age at that time.
And what age were the lads that you were playing with?
Well, most of them were the lads who lived around the square. Yeah. You know, they might be a year or two, but some of them might have been the same age as myself.
Were any of them ever better than you?
Well, I don't think any of them went on to win the cup like you were talking about. But they were good. We were really good lads, you know. Yeah. We had to try to get into a competition as a team, you know. And the only team we could get into was the Sodality League, and you had to go. We used to call it playing for religion. You had to go one of the churches. I can't remember the name now. Thursday and Sunday, and you could get a team to play in the Sodality League. It was called the Sodality League. Played in up in the 15 acres. And that's where we started playing, in the Sodality League. We never won a match.
And were you, when you're playing with the lads and you're taking the ball home and you're practicing your skills, are you thinking, you know what, I want to make it, I want to play for Ireland? Or are you just doing it because you love it?
No, I didn't. Did it because I was enjoying it. I was too young. I was only sort of 7, 8 years of age at that time. I used to go to the matches with my father because my father was a big football man, and he'd take me up to Daily Mount for the international matches and that. And actually, he was a coach at Drumcondra at that time, which I used to go to, and even go down the country with the bus, with the thing, you know, with the Drumcondra. Playing in the Sodality League, he wasn't involved in that. You know, we only played there for a couple of seasons, and then we joined. My father started running a team as well at that time when I was about 8 or 9 or 10, which was ideal for him because he was watching me playing. My father had a great skill at football. He was really, really very, very good. So from a young age, playing in a match, he'd say to me, "You remember that incident you were in? You could have done that, you could have done that, you could have done that," which was huge, you know, because the youngest you could play in those days was under 14.
And were you lapping that up? Were you trying to absorb all that, or were you saying, "Give it a rest of that"?
Luckily enough, I was, in football in terms, school, hopeless. Football, I would know exactly what my father was talking about. See, I'm being a bit religious now. I always felt when I was a young kid, I had a gift. It was a gift to play football at the level I could play it. I always believed that. And I'm not religious at all.
And did that make sure that you were not throwing that away, or every single day that you went out to play, maybe you worked that bit harder?
Yeah, see, football, people will tell you football's a simple game. Football's not a simple game. Football's a very, very calculated, serious game. And because if you look at football, you've got 20 players on the pitch in a certain area with one ball. That's a lot, right? So obviously you have to learn how to do it. My father was very good. Don't get ahead of the ball. Stay behind the ball. There was lots of things he was telling me at that particular time which helped on the way. Like I played 6 years under 14. But that was all... But that was all learning. My father was very, very good at it. You know, he could reduce it to simplicity to say, see in that position, because he used to come to the matches, you should have been over there. You shouldn't have got ahead of the ball. You should have done this. Loads of things you shouldn't be doing in football that you have to learn to do. And he was very good at that.
How did your mother feel about you playing with lads 6 years older than you?
No, my mother enjoyed me playing football. You know, like football around Ormond Square where I was with my pals kept you out of trouble. There was a lot of trouble going on in those days. We were in Ormond Square. It wasn't one of the major places in Dublin. You know, it was this very, very type of area that was real dub. And that's what it was great for us. Like, we had a ball and we could play from morning till night playing football at that. That was for fun. You know, as it happens for my sake, I'm learning this, the trouble, because I lived in the square. Some of the lads didn't live in the square. So I had the bouncer. So I could go out and start keeping it up myself before the lads came in. That all counts in the long run, in controlling the ball. I mean, you know, we all know, most people here know, controlling the ball. And if you can't control the ball, you're hopeless. You know, controlling the ball is everything. Then distributing the ball and doing what you have to do with the ball, getting into a positional sense, into a positional decision. It's a very complicated game, football. Can be. I mean, the great players reduce it as best they can, because you see a player playing and he's got plenty of space on the ball and he's knocking the ball around. It doesn't happen by accident.
The influence that your dad had on you and how you played a game, when you went to Manchester United, and you know Jimmy Murphy is a name you would often have spoken about, who looked after the young kids. Were the things your dad spoke to you about, were they similar when you went to Manchester United? Were they things that you were able to go back to throughout your career?
Well, I went to Manchester when I was 15, and my father wanted me to do everything. He thought I should go and learn a trade, which I did for 12 months.
What did you do?
I learned nothing. I was only 15, so I played in the Manchester United Juniors, which played in the Altrincham's Junior League, underage. Uh, sorry, no age limit. So that's where I played mostly the first year. And I was only 15, 16, and then Jimmy Murphy and Matt Busby, well, mostly Jimmy Murphy, decided, which I knew before, I was never going to learn a trade. So I was 16 then. So they brought me in, like, as a full-time player. And I then got in the what was the A team and the B team at that particular time.
We speak to lots of young players or players who didn't make it, who were brilliant at 15 or 16, and for one reason or another, it never happened for them.
Yeah.
Considering you were so good and you're going to Manchester United at 15, did you ever lose the run of yourself when you were that age? Did you ever get a bit cocky?
No. There was nothing to get cocky about. You know, well, I felt, and see, everybody's different in what they want, and their personalities are different in what they want. I never felt that way. I never felt cocky about playing. I might be cocky on the pitch and doing what I should be doing, but I never felt cocky about it. I never felt that. I always felt, you have to get better. You have to get better. You know, you have to do this. You have to do that. Now, my father was very good for that. Before I went to England, John, you went too far ahead of the ball. But I knew what he was talking about, you know. And you had to, there's no way you could play in a match where you can't get any better.
Yeah.
You can't.
Is that as much of the gift as when you talk about the talent that you have, to have that mentality?
Oh, yeah. Well, the mentality had to be there. Norman, I played with Norman Hunters, a couple of lads here. Norman Hunter was a great player. Great player. But when we finished, I used to see him, and he said, "Do you miss it?" And I said, "No, I don't, Norman." He said, "Oh, I miss it. I really miss it." But I was nearly 40 when I finished. And when I finished, honestly felt a relief.
Why?
You couldn't have done any more. You know, like if you know early on, this is a gift, right? And I got to the stage where I couldn't do it anymore. But I wasn't sorry. I was relieved.
Jeez, how lucky are you?
I've done it.
I've had that career.
Gift,
that
yeah.
So
yeah.
Few players, I'd imagine, would sit here and say, I did everything I could with my talent.
Yeah, I didn't say it that way. But
I'm saying it that way for you.
But I'm only explaining to Norman. Norman was one of the great, well, there's a couple of lads here. Norman was one of the great players of all time, in my opinion. Great lad, really, really great lad. And he did miss it. He really missed it badly because that's the way he was. When he played that way. But I'm only saying, I said, no, I don't miss it, Norman. I did what I had to do, and that's, I couldn't do it anymore.
John, can we talk a little bit about the Republic of Ireland debut? We've played a clip of audio earlier on. Do you want to describe to us the goal that we cannot get the footage of from Lansdowne Road?
I'd be delighted to. It was, I think I'd only played a couple of matches in the first team. Now, this was the time when the selectors were doing their job. And I think one of the selectors saw me playing in the Central League and I played well. This is when he played on a Sunday. As it happened, we had a U team match in Tolka Park. I think it was on the Wednesday of that week. And then it was Thursday. And Jimmy Murphy was taking me back because there was maybe too much about the press in there. And we got to the airport and the plane wasn't taken off for another 4 hours. So he said, well, you might as well stay at home and because it's on Sunday anyway. But in those days, see, playing on Sunday, I was lucky enough because I was in the reserves at Manchester United at that time. I think I was 18. Most of the other players, sorry, what you mean, if you didn't come back, I can come on Sunday. You were playing on Sunday. And nearly all the lads played on Saturday and had to get the boat or whatever they saw, mostly the boat, to come home and play on Sunday. That's the way it was in those days. Well, I was lucky enough. I'd have played on the Wednesday against Home Farm at Tolka under 18. So I had a rest. I'd met up in the hotel. What's the... Gresham. That's where you met on the, say, at 12 o'clock. I didn't know any of the players. I think, Joe Carden was a player who played with Manchester United. But I think I'd only played a few matches. But I didn't know any. I knew of the players. There was Noel Cantwell and Charlie Hurley, all these great players that I'd watched playing. So it was, you only had a meal, and then you're up to Daily Mount. There was no room for Jackie Carey, who was the manager. The great Jackie Carey was a brilliant player. And that was it. You'd stripped off, and there was no practice match or anything like that. But that's the way it was in those days. And we played Sweden. Sweden were a good side. But we went two down in the match. We were hopeless, two down. And I was playing in midfield. And look, I scored. The goalkeeper was across from the right wing. Goalkeeper came out and punched it. Yeah, he got a good punch on it. And I had just delivered it to the right wing. So I was pretty much well way back coming up. But I came onto it. And it only bounced once. And I hit it on the volley. Screamed in the top corner. And then we went on to win the match 3-2. You know, you couldn't make it up as a young fella. Playing in your first match, two down, crowd getting a bit impatient, and we win 3-2.
Wow.
Amazing. It must be like an amazing thing at that moment for you personally, but also in terms of your dreams, no doubt, to play in a major international tournament. For example, Sweden had just beaten England, I think, at Wembley the week beforehand, and you were just arriving onto the scene. You must have really been thinking at that point, my new dream is to play in a World Cup.
I was thinking that much about certain things. I can't remember what I was thinking about. I used to go to Daily Mount with my father for all the international matches. He used to take me to all the international matches. So I knew as a kid, like most of my pals of that, your dream was to play in the international team. And as it happened, I'd only played, I think I'd played two matches. And I'm playing in a situation that I could remember when I was a kid going to the matches. So it's nothing you can describe about it. It's just like a dream. We're not like most kids. You wanted to play for Ireland. You used to go to the matches. You spent daily money. You used to go with my father. And now you're playing. And it goes so quickly. I think I was 18. I wasn't quite 19 at the time. And again, hitting the goal that you dream about and winning the match. So that was it. I mean, if you want a dream, that's a dream.
Yeah, it certainly is. And also that beautiful full circle moment of going to Daily Mount to watch Jackie Carey play.
All the time.
And then he's your manager giving you your instructions before your first appearance.
Carey was brilliant. You know, I was a Manchester United supporter from a distance because of Jackie Carey.
Right.
Jackie Carey won the Cup at Manchester United and come back a long time. I think it was in 1948. When they won the cup, with all these great players, but Carey was the captain. He was brilliant. He was brilliant, and he was the manager, obviously, at the team that I played in for my first international match. It was just a dream team, you know, like a kid, you're dreaming about playing it, and that's the way it was.
I should say that one of the golden rules we've had of road shows through the years when we've had John on is not to bring up the selection committee, because I fear we'll be here till midnight. You weren't a fan?
Oh, I hated them. I hated the international team. Because I was playing in the team at this time. And what the international team was called the Big Five, right? And the Big Five came from a director or owner of Rovers, or Cork or something. They never kicked the ball in their life. Never. They were hopeless. They wouldn't know how to kick a ball. And they're picking the team, right? And all they wanted was to, if it was a Cork selector, he'd want a Cork player on the team. Or Shamrock Rovers. That's what they were fighting for. And that was what was happening, right? So Jackie Carey, he put up with that. You're talking about later on when I became... Actually, we got rid of them before I became manager. We got together. I think it was Mick Meegan was a terrific player. He was the manager. And we got together and... that was it. It was one of the matches. I was left out of the match. I was left out of the team. And I asked why. Because I was playing for Leeds at the time. Because I don't put it in for the international team as I do for Leeds. Load of crap, you know what I mean? And they're picking the players in that. And that's one of the things I think I did well. When I became manager around that time, we got all the players together. I was one of the older players at that time, and we got together to get rid of the big five. So it's the manager can be in charge of the team, which is, it's only common sense. I mean, England at that time said Ramsey, they'd done that for 4 years before we did. But the big five didn't like it, you know.
And imagine us.
No, didn't like me either. But we got rid of them. We got rid of them. And we were a lot better. You know, we were. Well, it's only common sense. I mean, if you got a big five picking a team, you know nothing about football, and they're picking the international team, it just doesn't make sense at all.
John, we will be reflecting on the glory days at Leeds United very shortly with a couple of your teammates. I just had one question about Manchester United before we go there. And I know John Stiles is in the audience with us tonight. It's about Nobby Stiles at Manchester United. Going back, reading your book this week, you described him as the moral core of that Manchester United side. Can you talk a little bit more about Nobby at Manchester United?
Yeah, under Busby? I was a kid as a Manchester United thing. But the time you're talking about, I was 22. I wasn't a kid anymore. So you get to know, are your dreams come true or not? You know, at that stage when I was 22, and at that stage, for the cup final itself, I'd played in every match leading up to the cup final. And funny enough, Nobby was involved in it. Albert Quicksaw was okay. But Nobby got injured. Right, and I played in every match, but there's no doubt I wouldn't have played in the final. I did play in the if Nobby had been fit enough to play in it, and I knew that. I didn't think I was being treated very well at all. But I played in the final, and then we were in the close season then, and I went to see Sir Matt, as I think Matt is here, and it was actually I made it a little bit about the money. I said I'm not signing for that. Now, I knew I was the last person Matt Busby wanted to see, coming to see him about signing his contract. And Matt was the type, he kept it very cool. He had blue eyes. And I found with him, when he lost his temper, his blue eyes used to sparkle.
Right.
So when I was talking to him about, I was the last person that he needed to see about not signing the contract, you know. And I was with him and I said, I don't think that's right. That's not right. And his eyes got bluer and bluer. And they were like diamonds by the time I'd finished. And but I had played in every round of the cup final. And I wasn't happy about at all, despite the fact that we won. So he decided then he'd put me on the transfer list. Or I said, well, put me on the transfer list. And I made a little bit about money, because Matt didn't throw the money around. You know, we won the cup and we got little or no bonus or anything like that. And I was giving him cheek as well, you know. And in fact, we were on very low money and he was giving us a five or tenner. And he said, you'll find that all the clubs are doing that. And I had spoken to Charlie Hurley, who was an Irish international. He was in the second division. And I was able to say, Charlie, what's your contract for next year? He was able to tell me. I think it was 100 quid a week he was getting. We were getting 50 quid a week. And Matt Busby said, well, you'll find that wherever you go, all the clubs are getting the same money. And I said, no, that's not true. I didn't say it was Charlie Hurley. But I said, you don't do that with Matt Busby. Do you know what I mean? Like, straight away, he put me on the transfer list. And that was it.
That was it at Manchester United. And I'm sure it was a time of real uncertainty, but it couldn't have worked out any better with what happened at Leeds United over the next 10, 12 years.
I said I would haunt him. We just got married at that time as well. And I said I would haunt him, which I did. But then I was like 12 years at Leeds. But I think after 8 years, somebody, when we were doing well and I was playing an inside forward and all that, asked Matt, did he make a mistake? And he said he did. I couldn't believe it.